From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, producing exploitation movies like Night Call Nurses and Humanoids from the Deep, while distributing foreign art films like Cries and Whispers and Amarcord, it's the second part of our interview with Roger Corman. Also today, a talk with the lead singer on the 1959 hits Mr. Blue and Come Softly to Me. The Fleetwoods have a new reissue. World music critic Milo Miles cranks up some Caribbean soca music. And critic Maureen Carrigan checks out the resurrected Ms. Magazine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In a surprise announcement, Iraq says it will start withdrawing its troops on Sunday. But the statement carried on Baghdad media said the pullback wouldn't take place if Iraq or Kuwait were threatened by outside powers. And the statement insisted the old Kuwaiti regime would not be reinstalled. Mike Theodulu reports from Nicosia.
Iraq was obviously surprised by the breadth of international condemnation, which included a joint statement from the superpowers and a call by the Arab League for an immediate withdrawal. Saddam Hussein has also been under intense diplomatic pressure from Arab leaders, including close allies like Jordan's King Hussein, to defuse the crisis. But Iraq is desperately trying to save face. It insisted it wasn't responding to pressure and vowed to smash any outside interference. It didn't say how long the withdrawal would take or how many troops would be pulled out. It could still use the excuse that it can't pull out entirely while U.S. warships are in the Gulf. Iraq's mysterious puppet regime in Kuwait has been on Baghdad radio to say it agrees with an Iraqi withdrawal now that security and stability have been achieved. The Kuwaiti people, it claimed, were now living in freedom and dignity after darkness had been removed. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
The House defied a presidential veto threat today and passed landmark civil rights legislation. The Civil Rights Act of 1990 passed on a vote of 272 to 154. It now goes to a House-Senate conference committee where prospects for a compromise are said to be bright. The Senate approved its own version of the bill 2 weeks ago. The Senate is debating President Bush's $307 billion defense budget for next fiscal year. Senators are hoping to finish up work on the measure before their summer recess, but they still have a large number of amendments to deal with before a final vote on the package. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from Capitol Hill.
The Senate has rejected a number of efforts today to make deeper cuts in the defense budget than the $18 billion in reductions already recommended by the Armed Services Committee. A move to cut troop levels next year by 130,000 was rejected. So was an amendment calling on the Navy to retire three of its four battleships, one more than the administration has proposed. Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona argued that in the wake of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, this was no time to be mothballing battleships.
I don't have to make the case for the battleship, Mr. President. Saddam Hussein has made the case for the battleship.
The Senate also put aside a potentially controversial effort to allow abortions in military hospitals for personnel and their dependents willing to pay for the procedure. Debate on the defense bill is expected to last late into the night and possibly tomorrow. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Prices on Wall Street plunged today in the busiest trading of the year. When it was all over, the Dow lost almost 55 points to close at 2,809.65. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of today's successful actors and directors got their start turning out low-budget quickies for my guest Roger Corman. People like Jack Nicholson, Martin Scorsese, John Sayles, Francis Ford Coppola, Robert Towne, and Robert De Niro. Corman has written a new book, How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. And yesterday, he told us just some of his techniques for making exploitation films. More about his work as a director, producer, and distributor today in part two of our conversation. Corman directed over 50 movies in the 1950s and 60s, including A Bucket of Blood, Little Shop of Horrors, The Pit and the Pendulum, and The Wasp Woman. Since 1970, his companies New World Pictures and Concord produced hundreds of action and science fiction films. In 1966, Corman directed the movie Wild Angels, starring Peter Fonda as the head of a motorcycle gang. The movie not only launched Fonda's career, it helped give Fonda the idea of making Easy Rider. This is the story behind Corman's biker film.
There was a lot of talk about the Hells Angels at that time, and I remember in, it was either Time or Newsweek magazine, there was an article on them, and at the top of the page was a picture of a Hells Angels funeral. It took place in some woods, and they were carrying the coffin, but the members were riding their bikes. And the visual power of that photograph really impressed me. And I was having lunch with Jim Nicholson and Sam Arkoff, who ran American International, and we were talking about various ideas for a film that we might do together, and it kind of came up between all of us that we all thought the Hells Angels would be a good subject. So we agreed that we would do a film about the Hells Angels. I wanted the Hells Angels not to be the nemesis, the heavies. I wanted them to be the leads in the picture. So I developed with Chuck Griffith my own script, which eventually became the Wild Angels. And for a little while there, I and Chuck were hanging out with the angels, going to their parties and so forth. And the picture became a loose compendium of stories they told us about things that they had done.
So tell me what you were like when you were hanging out at Hell's Angels parties.
I was not quite one of the angels. I made a point of bringing the beer and possibly helping to bring some marijuana and one thing and others. And Chuck and I were reasonably well accepted, but we were never quite with them. I remember at one time I had spent a lot of the evening sitting drinking beer and talking with the old lady that is the girlfriend of the president of the chapter of the Hell's Angels. And Chuck came over to me and he said, "You're spending too much time talking to that girl. The leader of the angels has been watching you. He doesn't like it in any way whatsoever." And I realized for a little while I had forgotten what kind of party I was at and where I was. So I said goodbye to her and went over and talked to some guys about some bikes.
Now, you cast some actual Hells Angels as extras in the movie, right?
Yes. We had members of the Venice and San Bernardino chapters of the Hells Angels.
Did they give you any trouble?
No, they didn't really give me trouble. I was very careful as to how I was going to handle them. I thought about it, and I thought, I'm not going to be able to order them around, and that's not my style as a director anyway. On the other hand, I can't appear to be too weak because they'll start to push me around. So I determined that the thing to do was try to be as objective and unemotional as I could and simply to say, all right, fellas, the bikes start here. You're going to ride up to here, you're going to turn around that corner, and you're going to pull up in front of that bar over there, and you pull out and you run into the bar. And I would try to say it that way so it was clear what I wanted, but that I wasn't trying to force them to do anything. And I think they understood and appreciated that, and by and large, we got along pretty well.
Did you pay them well?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I don't remember the exact amounts of money, but it was interesting. We worked out the payment. They got a certain amount of money per day for each angel, and then they got a little bit less than their personal fee to bring their bikes, and then they got a little bit less than the bikes for bringing their women. So this was their scale of values.
Didn't the Hells Angels sue you over one movie for using their name and insignia?
Yes, it wasn't so much the name and the insignia because I'd signed a contract with them, but after the Wild Angels came out and was successful, they sued me for defamation of character. And I remember watching television when the announcer said announced the lawsuit, and he was evidently reading from a teleprompter or something, and he said they were suing me because I had portrayed them as an outlaw motorcycle gang when in reality they were a social organization dedicated to the spreading of technical information about motorcycles. And the announcer started laughing in the middle of the television broadcast.
Peter Fonda starred in Wild Angels as like the head of the biker gang. He later starred with Dennis Hopper in Easy Rider. But in Wild Angels, there's something very innocent and vulnerable looking about him in spite of the way that he's cast. Did you realize that at the time?
I knew that, and it was a little bit of a problem because I wanted Peter in the film. He was a good actor. He had the right persona, but he's a very tall, thin person, and he wasn't really as tough or as tough-looking as the angels. For that reason, I had him wear a couple of layers of clothing throughout the film in order to build up a little bulk. So I was aware of that, but I did what I could.
You made the movie The Trip, which was one of the first psychedelic features. Peter Fonda starred in that as someone who makes TV ads and decides to take his first trip. And most of the movie is what the trip is like. Now, the movie opens with a crawl and a voiceover narration, and the crawl says, "The illegal manufacture and distribution of these drugs is dangerous and can have fatal consequences. This picture represents a shocking commentary on a prevalent trend of our time and one that must be of great concern to all." Is this a sentiment that you believed in, or was this obligatory to the genre, that, you know, to the teen genre? Not that this was a teen movie, but, you know, that you had to have a disclaimer before you actually started the psychedelic trip.
I'd like to disclaim the disclaimer.
Uh-huh.
I had nothing to do with that whatsoever.
Okay.
I shot the film, and American International was a little bit surprised when they saw it. They felt that maybe I'd gone a little bit farther than I might have, and they put that disclaimer on the picture themselves before they released it. I thought it was a bad idea, and I still think it's a bad idea.
Why?
I thought it was corny. The film stood on its own. I didn't think you had to say anything about the film. I think the film just should have played. They played around with the ending. I had set up a very intricate dolly shot ending up with Peter walking out of a house at the beach and looking at the sun as it was coming up. And it was a very difficult shot to get. And they cut that shot up in the final version of the picture and put some sort of a crack across the screen to try to show that his life was partially destroyed as a result of the trip, whereas the theme of the picture was open-ended, that something had happened to him, and I was not saying it was either good or bad. I was just saying here is a new day, something has taken place. The fact that they put that crack in, they thought would say that it was bad. The fact of the matter is it just looked kind of dumb, and I don't think the audience understood what it was about in any way.
Now, just as you hung out with the Hells Angels before making Wild Angels, you dropped acid once, I believe, before making The Trip.
Yes.
So how did that pay off in the making of the movie?
I think it was a necessary and a good experience to have made a picture about an LSD trip without having taken one. I think would have been almost disastrous. I would not really have understood what it was I was making the picture about. It did have an unintended effect, however, in that my trip was totally good. I had nothing but good images. And in trying to be fair, I then, in preparing the film, talked to people who had had bad trips and got some information and insight from them and tried to put elements of both good trips and bad trips in the picture because I was trying to be, as it were, impartial. I didn't want to make everything good.
Roger Corman is my guest. He's a producer, director, and distributor. He's made hundreds of movies. He's famous for making movies fast and cheap. Some of his movies include Little Shop of Horrors, Bloody Mama, The Wild Angels, Pit and the Pendulum, Tomb of Ligeia. Many actors and directors got their start working for him, including Martin Scorsese, Jonathan Demme, Joe Dante, Jack Nicholson, and John Sayles. So many of the actors, directors, and screenwriters who got their start with you moved on and made big-budget movies after that, which is something that you really never did. I'm sure you could have, but you chose to stay doing what you were doing. I mean, you formed your own company, so you were doing it for yourself, but you were still turning out quickies for the most part. Why did you want to keep doing that when you had the power and the money to make more expensive movies and to take a longer time doing it?
I had worked several times with the major studios, and as a matter of fact, I was offered a contract with a major studio to continue working for them when I stopped directing in 1970. The problem always seemed to be that a great deal of the decision-making was taken out of my hands. The studio would say, you're going to use this actor, or we want this approach. And I just felt more comfortable on my own. I felt that if I was going to make a mistake, I wanted it to be my mistake. I wanted to be able to make whatever type of film I wanted to make the way I wanted to make it. This, of course, as you say, did have the disadvantage of that it held me into lower budget films, although more recently my budgets have been climbing a little bit. But for most of my career, it has meant that in order to obtain independence, I had to do less expensive films.
Is it easier to make money, or is there more money to be made turning out a lot of cheaper movies than a few expensive ones?
It can go either way.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a film that breaks through for $100 million and make a great deal of money on that one film, yet you know that the majority of those big films will lose. So it's like shooting a three-point shot in basketball. The odds are against you hitting the three-point shot, but if you do hit, you get 3 points. Whereas if you're making lower-budget films, it'd be like hitting two-point shots. You're in there closer, you have a higher percentage of scoring, but you know that your score will be a little bit less on each individual shot.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is producer, director, and distributor Roger Corman, who has a new book called How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. This is Fresh Air. Roger Corman is my guest. The man is known as the king of the fast, cheap movie. He's made zillions of movies over the years. Just a few of them are Little Shop of Horrors, Bloody Mama, Wild Angels, Pit and the Pendulum, Tomb of Ligeia. Many of today's leading actors and directors got their start with Corman, including Martin Scorsese, Jonathan Demme, Joe Dante, Jack Nicholson, and John Sayles. In 1970, you gave up directing, and you left American International Pictures to form your own company, New World Pictures. Why did you want to give up directing?
I was tired. I had directed a little bit over 50 pictures in about 15 years, and the last picture I directed was called Von Richthofen and Brown. It was a World War I flying picture that we were shooting in Ireland, primarily because there were some World War I planes in Ireland. And every morning, I was living in an apartment in Dublin, and every morning I would drive out to the airport, which was our base of operations. And on the way to the airport, there was a fork in the road, and to the right, it said Galway Bay, and to the left was the airport. And every morning, I was tempted to turn to the right, drive to Galway Bay, and just sit there looking out over the Atlantic Ocean. But dutifully, every morning, I drove to the airport and did my work. But I knew that I had to stop, that my heart really wasn't in it anymore. So I completed that film, and what I thought I would do was just take a year off, take the traditional sabbatical, and come back to directing. And I was offered a contract, as I said, at a major studio at the time, and I said, let me wait a year. I really don't want to do it now. And during that year, I thought what I might do is start a little production and distribution company, just as a partially as a hobby, as an investment, and just to have something to do, and then turn it over to somebody, and that was New World Pictures. It grew very rapidly, and I couldn't really find anybody I felt was qualified to take it over, so I ended up running it myself, and year followed year followed year, and I never did get back to directing until the Frankenstein Unbound project, and that actually was suggested to me by Universal Pictures. It wasn't even my idea to start with.
Did your approach to making movies change when you were overseeing production as the head of the production company as opposed to directing yourself?
My basic approach did not change and has not changed. However, being the production company, you look at the same problem from a somewhat different point of view. I still believe in a great deal of preparation, a tremendous amount of planning in the pre-production stages, and then shooting efficiently during the actual shooting schedule. And I talk with the directors I work with about that and try to instill that concept in them so that they're shooting to at least a certain extent in the style I feel comfortable with.
As the head of a production company, if somebody goes over budget or if they take a longer time to shoot than you had allotted, do you fire them?
I've never fired a director, but I will have some very strong conversations with him, and we really don't go much over budget or over schedule. We stay very close to our budgets and schedules.
Tell me a clever way that you perhaps came up with once to end a movie quickly after it started to go over budget or over length.
I remember one time when it was clear that a film was going over schedule. So I rearranged the schedule and had the director shoot the ending of the picture. And then I said to him, we've got the beginning and we've got the ending of the picture. You're over budget and over schedule. You have this many days that I'm giving you. Shoot whatever you want that's left in the picture in this allotted time. And when it's over, know that the picture is over, and whatever you shoot will be the picture.
Name some of the titles of recent movies that your company has produced.
Some of our recent releases are Body Chemistry, Streets, Blood Fist. Blood Fist, starring Don the Dragon Wilson, the world's light heavyweight kickboxing champion, was our biggest success this last year. Some of the films we've completed that are about to come out, Full Fathom 5, a submarine picture, will be coming out in a couple of months. Slumber Party Massacre Part 3 will be coming out. Blood Fist 2 will be with us in the fall. We've got a number of other films. We've got a picture that we start shooting in 2 weeks in Brazil called Fire on the Amazon, which is a thriller with a background of the destruction of the Brazilian rainforest. I have very high hopes for that film. We'll be shooting a picture in September in Germany and in Bulgaria called The Day the Wall Came Down, which is a spy story laid against the destruction of the Berlin Wall.
It'd take a movie like Blood Fist, Part 1. Now, I don't remember seeing that playing in my neighborhood. I don't remember seeing that playing in the nearby shopping malls. Where do movies like that play now?
A picture such as Blood Fist will play for our company somewhere between 500 and 800 dates in theaters dispersed pretty evenly throughout the country. We'll play to a large extent in suburban multiplexes, theaters with 3, 4, 5 or more screens. But even with a picture such as Blood Fist, which was a success for us theatrically, the bulk of the money came from home video. It was a moderate success for us theatrically, which is about all we can hope for anymore with a low-budget or medium-budget film. But it was a big success in home video. It sold almost 100,000 cassettes, which is a giant number for an independent film.
You know, in the same period that you were making movies like Blood Fist and Slumber Party Massacre, you were also distributing foreign films, films by Ingmar Bergman, Cries and Whispers. You distributed The Tin Drum. Why did you get into distributing art films? And this was in the late 70s or early 80s that you started doing this, I think. It had to be earlier than that.
It was the mid-70s.
Yeah.
I got into distributing art films simply because I wanted to do it. New World was growing very rapidly, and I was very pleased with the growth of the company, but I felt that we were becoming known too much as an American independent exploitation-minded company, and I wanted to change that image a little bit. And at the same time, I had always admired, as a matter of fact, I'd always loved the works of Bergman, Fellini, Truffaut, Kurosawa, and so forth, and I felt that their films were not really being distributed well in the United States. And I heard that Bergman's newest film at that time, Cries and Whispers, did not have an American distributor. And I remember telling Paul Koner, his agent, I'll take the picture sight unseen. And he said yes, and we made the deal, and I got a letter from Ingmar Bergman thanking me and then suggesting that I see the film and saying that he would give me an out and I could tear up the contract if I didn't like the film. Well, I saw the film and thought it was a wonderful film, and we distributed it, and it did very well.
Did you try distributing foreign art films to drive-ins and to the kinds of theaters that you were used to booking exploitation films in?
We did indeed. After Cries and Whispers had won the Academy Award, had played all the art theaters, had played some commercial theaters, there was a slight shortage of films at that time for drive-ins. So we put it in a few drive-ins, and people were saying, you can't put an Ingmar Bergman film in a drive-in. And to everybody's surprise, the film did average business in drive-ins. The drive-in theater owners were very happy. They had a film, an additional film that did average business for them. We were happy. And I got another letter from Ingmar Bergman thanking me, saying that first, it was added revenue. And also, he was delighted that an audience that would not normally see his films was seeing them.
Roger Corman is my guest. In the fall, your movie Frankenstein Unbound will be released, the first movie you've directed in about 18 years. Why did you decide to go back into directing?
I actually didn't decide to go back into directing. A few years ago, Universal Pictures did some market research without telling me, but that's okay. And they did this research and came up with the information that a picture called Roger Corman's Frankenstein would be successful. And they asked me if I would like to make my comeback as a director and do Roger Corman's Frankenstein. And I said, as a matter of fact, I don't really want to do it. There have been so many Frankenstein pictures. It would be the 85th or 90th Frankenstein picture, and I don't really have anything new to bring to the Frankenstein story, so I turned them down. And then Tom Mount, who'd been head of production at Universal, left to form his own company, the Mount Company, and he called me and said he had financing if I had any ideas. And then I remembered a book written by Brian Aldiss about 10 years earlier called Frankenstein Unbound, which I should have remembered earlier, but it was just out of my mind. And I said, I really liked that book because it was a completely original interpretation of the Frankenstein story, and I had a couple of ideas of my own that I thought could integrate with Brian's work, and we might make a very good picture. And so we agreed to do that. And it's a very, very strange picture that would be part horror film, part science fiction, and part fantasy. It is a pure entertainment on the surface level, and maybe somewhere beneath the surface, subtextually, there might be a little bit of statement about the meaning of science and its relationship to our culture.
How closely do you stay in touch with all the actors and directors and screenwriters who you gave their start?
I stay in reasonable touch with them. We're not all close or intimate friends anymore, but we see each other from time to time. For instance, Jack Nicholson, who not only starred in but directed Two Jakes, which is opening shortly, called me and offered me a part as an actor. He wanted me to play an establishment lawyer who he defeats in court with crooked evidence. And I said, Jack, why do you want to beat me in court with crooked evidence? But I couldn't play the part because I was directing Frankenstein Unbound at the time. But then after I finished Frankenstein, Jonathan Demme called me and asked me to play the head of the FBI in his picture, Silence of the Lambs. And I had time to play that, so I am indeed the head of the FBI.
You feel suited to the role?
Well, I keep being offered that type of role. You know, I'm not really an actor. But for Francis Coppola, I played a senator, and then I was offered the part of a lawyer. I played a district attorney for Paul Bartel.
So why is the king of exploitation being given all these roles as establishment figures?
I don't know. Maybe in their eyes I am an establishment figure, and maybe it's the fact that I'm growing older. However, Joe Dante had me play a bum, and I was delighted to play that.
Which movie?
The original Howling.
Okay. Roger Corman, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Roger Corman's new book is How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, writer Hubert Selby, author of the urban classic Last Exit to Brooklyn, which has been made into a film. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Wind and storm, gone's the sun, run the stars, my dark has come, you've gone from me.
One critic said they had the most weightless harmonies ever recorded. The Fleetwoods have a new Best Of collection with their hits Mr. Blue and Come Softly. Coming up, we meet the lead singer. Also, world music commentator Milo Miles has some hot music for the hottest days of summer, soca music from Trinidad and Tobago. And commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us if the new Ms. Magazine is worth the new price. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The government of Iraq has announced plans to start withdrawing its troops from Kuwait by Sunday. But the announcement came with a condition, and the Bush administration has indicated some skepticism. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Iraqi announcement warned that the planned withdrawal could be jeopardized if, quote, something appears which could threaten the security of Kuwait and Iraq, end quote. Minutes earlier, President Bush told reporters that he wasn't ruling out any option in response to the Iraqi invasion. When asked about reports that Soviet officials were predicting that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein would soon withdraw from Kuwait, the president responded with anger.
Well, let's see him haul him out right now, then.
A White House spokesman, Doug Davidson, said the U.S. would not recognize a Kuwaiti government backed by Iraq, saying, "To us, it's a puppet government. We don't consider it the legitimate government of Kuwait." I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The Iraqi announcement of a possible start of a pullout from Kuwait follows a day of intense diplomatic negotiations involving members of the Arab League. Jeffrey Phillips of the BBC reports that Jordan's King Hussein has been assuming a growing role in the talks since the invasion of Kuwait.
King Hussein of Jordan, who was in Egypt on Thursday, was today in Baghdad for talks with President Saddam Hussein. President Mubarak has also had a telephone conversation on the crisis with President George Bush. In Baghdad, King Hussein said that a mini-summit of Arab leaders would be held in Jeddah this weekend. King Hussein and President Mubarak will fly to Saudi Arabia for talks with King Fahd and the now exiled Emir of Kuwait, Sheikh Jaber al-Ahmed al-Sabah. King Hussein, a close ally of President Saddam Hussein, now appears to have taken up the role of principal mediator in this crisis, a role previously held by President Mubarak. The Egyptian leader's position may have been seriously undermined by President Saddam Hussein's apparent reneging on a commitment to Mr. Mubarak to resolve the crisis with Kuwait through negotiations.
Jeffrey Phillips, the BBC. In Washington, the U.S. has called on Iraq for information about 14 U.S. oil workers missing from Kuwait and believed to have been rounded up by Iraqi troops. U.S. officials are also trying to confirm rumors that other Americans might have been picked up by Iraqi troops who invaded Kuwait early Thursday. The Iraqi ambassador to Washington has denied that his country is holding any Americans. A strong earthquake struck parts of southern Iran today, a little over a month after a killer earthquake claimed some 40,000 lives. This latest earthquake measured 5.5 on the Richter scale. No word as yet on casualties or damage. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 55 points to close at 2,809.65, on volume of some 294 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, I talk with Gary Troxell of the vocal group The Fleetwoods. But first, the attempted coup on the Caribbean island of Trinidad has ended. Until now, most Americans knew very little of the politics of the island. We probably knew more about their music. They used to export calypso, but world music commentator Milo Miles says now it's soca.
Both in the original by the singer Arrow and in the cover version done by Buster Poindexter, Hot 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 is likely the most widely heard calypso-style song since the Andrews Sisters took the hit Rum and Coca-Cola from Lord Invader in the 40s. But Hot, Hot, Hot is only a whiff of the greatest summertime music in the world, the neo-calypso style now called soca, from soul calypso. There are many, many soca stars, but none more venerable than the Mighty Sparrow, who has indeed been around for a lot longer than soca itself. He was first crowned king performer at the Trinidad Carnival in 1956 when he was about 20, and he has produced a steady stream of hit records since then. The modern era of calypso can be said to begin with him, though he certainly has a full measure of the form's traditional virtues. Sparrow is a sly storyteller who can be caustic, tender, hilarious, or just bizarre. Plus, his voice is booming but sweet, rich with a kind of hyper-masculine ease. This Sparrow oldie mixes nursery rhyme and boast in a very durable blend.
I hear he had cancer, I hear he had yellow fever, something in his bladder, and a double dose of leukemia. Two gossip mongers gossiping, I stand up in a corner listening, before I could ask who they're talking about. A newspaper boy start to shout, HEPA, extra, read all about it, HEPA, yeah. Who killed the Sparrow? Nobody knows. If you see this woman with a flag in she hand, she bangs in belly, telling everybody Sparrow dead. Who killed the Sparrow?
Despite his assured success, Sparrow works hard to keep current and prides himself on his flair for vivid narrative and song. Although he did sing a tune called I Am Not a Soca Man, that is what his music is now, and his subjects are anything but nostalgic. A few years back, he had a hit criticizing the invasion of Grenada and scored again with this number called Afraid to Age.
Nowadays, you can't take no chance when you're deep in a little romance. Always be prepared, no effort should be spared. Social diseases to dread. Recklessly we played, no dangers in the tread. All who used to run afraid, 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 afraid. I tell you, afraid. It's I can't make it great. Why yeah, well, yeah, well, yeah, yeah, say. Throughout the village, it's on the rampage. The governor afraid, and the mayor afraid. Why yeah, why yeah.
Soca developed from calypso in the 70s. Largely as a result of the advent of synthesizers, disco, and funk. The song tempos, which were always fast, picked up even more. The tones became more harshly electronic, the bass became heavy and huge, and dancing became re-emphasized. Chasing trends and looking for a hit was understandable, since calypso performers both in New York and on the island saw they had a stale market. Even top draws like Sparrow sold only about 30 or 40,000 records. Interest has picked up some in the wake of Hot, 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 but soca records still go in and out of print chaotically. They remain poorly distributed, and no soca star is signed to a major label. It's a shame, because there are potent and adventurous performers out there. Arrow is, of course, the most familiar, but he's much more than the song Hot, Hot, Hot. Soca critics complain that the concentration on dancing is made for too many numbers that say no more than, come on, baby, let's soca, 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 and this is certainly true. However, Arrow manages about once or twice a record to come up with tunes that are both a little different with the horn charts or the synthesizer line and tell a saucy story as well. Another one of my favorites is Shadow, who's a bit like the William Blake of soca, writing eccentric songs about nighttime spirits and weird moods and encounters with women who frighten and attract him at the same time. Whatever, he's always raving about something different and unexpected. Soca collections are very numerous, However, they are often very scattershot affairs with a simple grab bag of songs from one year's carnival. Exceptions that you can still find are an anthology on Rounder Records called Say What, that features sexy double entendre soca's, and from a couple years back, the collection This Is Soca on Sire Records. This last includes a smashing selection of soca hits, the highlight of which is Black Stalin's song Burn Them, in which he helps St. Peter send racists to hell. And whether that can make you feel like you're down there with them, remember soca is your best chance to beat the heat.
Judgment morning, I'm by the gate and I'm waiting, because I'm begging the master, give me a walk with Peter. If have some sinners coming, with them I will be dealing, because the things that they do me, I want to fix them personally. Peter, wait.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. Maybe the best thing about a record reissue is that it gets you to listen to old music in a new context. And sometimes your opinion changes. The Fleetwoods have a new Best Of collection on Rhino Records. It includes their hits Mr. Blue and Come Softly to Me, two of the top 10 hits of 1959. I thought they were okay in 1959, but I was surprised by how much I liked them in 1990. We invited Gary Troxell of the Fleetwoods to join us from station KULW in Seattle, about 60 miles from his home. Gary, Gretchen Christopher, and Barbara Ellis started harmonizing together in high school in Olympia, Washington.
Our guardian star lost all his glow the day that I lost you. He lost all his glitter the day you said no, and his silver turned to blue.
Like him, I am doubtful that your love is true.
But if you decide to call on me, ask for Mr. Blue. I'm Mr. Blue. When you say you love me, by going out on the sly, proving your love isn't true.
Call me Mr. Blue. I'm Mr.
Gary, when was the last time the Fleetwoods performed together?
Oh, good question. I think it had to have been a middle 70s. An oldie show in Florida, I think, Miami.
Now, do you still perform by yourself?
Yes.
Do you use,
I have two new girls.
Two new girls?
Yes, two different girls.
So do you use the name The Fleetwoods?
Yes.
Well, how do Barbara and Gretchen feel about that?
Barbara doesn't feel anything about it, and Gretchen feels everything, and we're discussing that through our attorneys.
Oh, is Gretchen suing you because you're using the name The Fleetwoods?
She threatens.
Mm-hmm. Tell me the story of how you started singing with Barbara and Gretchen.
Well, originally they were, I think they got put a group together of girls only in Olympia about the time that I moved to Olympia from Carmel, California. And they had written, I don't know if they'd written Come Softly at that time, but they might have been kicking it around. And they wanted some additional music, I guess, for their group. And they tried the local band, and they didn't like that. And so the band suggested me on my trumpet, which in the end turned out to be kind of silly. Two girls' voices and the trumpet didn't quite make any kind of sense. So I was humming along, and that seemed to work a little better. And we sang songs like Sincerely and In the Still of the Night, that stuff. And as far as my part mixing with what the two girls had written for Come Softly, is just about like the liner notes say on Rhino's new CD. We were standing on a corner, and I was doing my thing. Only I was doing it about three times as fast. It was kind of a jazz thing. And Gretchen said, well, slow that down. That sounds like it'd fit what Barb and I have written, and that's how that happened.
So did you come up with the dumb doobie-doos?
Yes, I did.
Doobie-doo, dum-dum, dum-doo-dum, doobie-doo, dum-dum, dum-doo-dum, doobie-doo, dum-dum, dum-doo-dum, doobie-doo, dum-dum, dum-doo-dum, doobie-doo, dum-dum.
Come softly, darling. Softly, darling, come to me, stay. You're my obsession forever and a day.
I want you to know I love you so. Please hold me so tight.
How did the soft style that you had fit in with the times in the late 50s?
That's probably one of the reasons that we became popular, or I think anyway. We were such a difference, such a shock to the rock and roll. There were, well, I suppose our harmonies and our, we have a lot of modern harmonies in our singing. But I think that was one of the things that helped us was the softness. It's like night and day, kind of.
When you started recording, did you work out the arrangements yourself? Did the producer help with that?
Well, we wrote. Oh, we didn't actually write anything.
out the arrangements, I should say.
Yeah, we worked them out vocally, so that I guess you could say we were the vocal arrangers on almost everything. There was lots of songs that we wanted to sing that we couldn't because if it was okay for me, it would be difficult, or if it was a certain key for me to, so I could sing the range of the whole song, it might be difficult for the girls because of their harmony parts. And so there's lots of songs that we couldn't do.
What are your memories of touring in 1959?
I hated it.
Why?
Because I was homesick. I had never been away from home, and I thought it was terrible. Even with the girls. And Bob Reisdorf went along with us, and he was actually acting as our manager and road manager and publicist and everything else. He ran the company here in Seattle.
Who are some of the performers that you shared the bill with when you were touring?
Well, it was kind of interesting that it seemed like always be the same people. And I think that's because we were hooked up with a Dick Clark group. I don't know if they called it that at the time, but it seemed like it was Frankie Avalon, Paul Anka, Bobby Rydell, Connie Francis, and they were almost always on the same show. If we were anywhere, they were there. We sang with our first color television show was in Boston, and that was with Johnny Mathis.
Let me play some of The Great Imposter. One of the songs that you recorded in 1961. Did you choose this? Was this chosen for you?
Oh, yes. Well, it was written for us.
Oh, it was written for you?
Yeah, by Jackie D. Shannon and Sharon Shealy. And it was one that we could do, so we did it.
Well, I went and lost her to the great imposter. I stood and watched her fall, couldn't help her at all. Poetry, so sweet, has her at his feet. She thinks she's the one, but he has just begun. All her friends, they just watch her, for they know the great imposter. Don't she know he's on a stage?
it's not real, it's just a play. And he's playing the part.
But the Fleetwoods broke up in what, 1966?
Yeah, that's about right.
How come? What happened?
Well, number one, the record company did not renew our contract, and I've read that the British invasion kind of shoved people like us aside, and that could be very true because we didn't have anything on the charts by that time. So I guess we all went our own way.
What did you do after the Fleetwoods broke up? How did you make your living?
I went to work in a plywood mill in Anacortes. And during that time, that was for about 11 years, and during that time I did record with the help of Bonnie Guitar. Through her I recorded a record for Dot that didn't do much. It was kind of a country tune. It didn't do anything, but it was released at least. And eventually I got into the Longshore Union, ILWU, in Anacortes, which takes quite a while. I ended up waiting 16 years to get in there.
In the Longshoremen's Union?
Yes. That's what I'm doing now.
So you're still a longshoreman?
Yes.
But you're also performing. What, did you perform on weekends or what?
Yeah, that's just about all right now.
What has the new compact disc made you think about when you listened back to it for the first time?
Oh, the first thing I thought of was, how could they do this and make it sound so clear? Because I remember we would rustle paper. We could hear breathing. We could hear the other person's breathing. Or we could hear Bonnie played guitar real quietly over in the corner to kind of keep us in rhythm. And you could hear her fingers sliding on the strings. But that's all gone in the CD. It's amazing. It's like come from outer space or something.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gary Troxell, the best of the Fleetwoods, is on Rhino Records.
I'll never be the one to part. You found a place here in my heart. Go have your fun.
I'll have my fun.
Run around. I'll never leave you.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what stories from Kuwait?
We are once again, of course, attempting to find out what is going on right now, reaction from around the world, what we, the United States, and the USSR will do. We're taking a especially hard look at Saudi Arabia as President Saddam Hussein of Iraq's forces move south through Kuwait. U.S. oil prices is another area we'll be taking a hard look at. But we also have a few other subjects on our program tonight, Terry. The civil rights legislation, which is moving through the Congress, and German elections have been moved up.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The first issue of Ms. magazine was published in 1972. Ms. was founded by Gloria Steinem and a group of feminist writers. Like many magazines over the years, it has struggled with dwindling advertising pages, partly because Ms. wouldn't take sexist ads. The magazine ceased publication last November. Recently, Ms. staffers and readers convinced its current owner to bring the magazine back without advertising. The first issue has just hit the stands, but critic Maureen Corrigan had trouble finding it.
On Wednesday, I trudged all over Washington, D.C., searching for the new Ms. I tried all the big chain bookmarts. One young female clerk told me sympathetically, "Oh, MS? No, we don't carry that anymore." I felt like some kind of Rip Van Winkle, awakening to the grim, post-feminist age. Next, I tried a couple of radical bookstores, the ones where all the clerks look like Che Guevara. I might as well have been asking for TV Guide. Ms. was always too mainstream for those places. I finally found a copy in one of those hodgepodge drugstores that stock everything from Brilliantine to Whitman samplers. The cashier there said, "Whoa, this magazine sure has gone up." Sure has. The premier issue cost $4.50, $2 more than when it was last on the stand. I guess they have to make up for the absence of advertising somehow. Ms. is now a bi-monthly, so you're really paying for two issues, but the price is still steep. And what do you get for your money? Well, that's the good news. The newly liberated Ms. is invigorating and politically charged. One of the best pieces is Gloria Steinem's capsule history of the unholy alliance between advertisers and magazines. She shows how other women's magazines are little more than consumer catalogs. Other familiar voices are back, too. There's Bella Abzug with a personal essay on widowhood, and poetry by Audrian Rich, Toni Morrison, and June Jordan. New features include a health column by the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, the people who wrote Our Bodies Ourselves, and something called Accidental Activist that spotlights women who don't consider themselves political, but who've become involved in that one personal cause. Another new feature called Instant Classics revives consciousness-raising gems from the past. This issue has Judy Brady's 1972 essay, Why I Want a Wife. The new Ms. wants to go beyond expressing all women's experiences through just a white, middle-class, heterosexual voice. It also aims to be more international. This issue features a startling article on the women of Eastern Europe by Yugoslav feminist writer Slavenka Draculic. Despite the political transformations of the last year and a half, women in countries like Bulgaria live in medieval conditions. They lack sanitary napkins, let alone easy access to contraception and equal wages. Yet they're told to be patient until the more important work of the revolution is completed. Draculic calls this democracy with a male face. Given the options of making further accommodations to its advertisers or returning to its roots in feminist protest, Ms. made the right choice. But there's a hitch. Because of its high price, the women who write for Ms. will probably be more economically and culturally diverse than the women who read it. There's no good solution to this dilemma. Editorial freedom doesn't come cheap. I'm glad Ms. is back, and as Robin Morgan says, still crazy after all these years. Still crazy and still telling us what we need to know.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with writer Hubert Selby. His brutal urban classic, Last Exit to Brooklyn, has been made into a film. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead on the music of clarinetist George Lewis. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.